Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I am Daniel Emery Price. I am joined by Chad Bird. Chad, how are we doing this fine morning?
I'm doing good. Doing good. Got my Bible open. Got my coffee inside me. I'm raring to go.
That's all the gifts you need this morning for
that's
this
for this particular. Caffeine and scripture are ready to go.
Yes, sir. All right, man. Well, we left off at a pretty exciting spot. You wanna recap where we're at?
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, in fact, one of my friends from work, Gary, who listened to this program, he was upset with us because we left him hanging. You know, we bring you up to the climactic moment and then we make you wait.
Hey, man, we end when 40 minutes ends.
That's right. We have no control over this, right? All right, so so we're in Egypt, of course, with Joseph, have been for a while. But what happened last time is that, you know, that we had the dreams and Joseph's plan of action that he gave to Pharaoh, 7 years of plenty, 7 years of famine. So stock up during those 7 years, get ready because it's coming. And then it comes. And as we discussed, the famine wasn't just an Egyptian famine. It hit all the surrounding countries, so people hungry all over the place, not just the Egyptians. So this affects, as the famine includes more land, it affects Joseph's long-lost family back in the Promised Land. And so they send the group of brothers down there into Egypt to buy some grain and to bring back the food to feed the family. And they get down there, and surprise, surprise, they have trouble with this mysterious guy who's in charge of all the food in Egypt, which of course is Joseph, but they don't know it's Joseph because too much time has gone by in almost 20 years. So Joseph recognizes them, but they don't recognize Joseph. He disguises himself, and it says in verse 7 of chapter 42, that he spoke harshly to them. And the way he spoke harshly to them is he accused them of being a big spies. So they begin, you know, to defend themselves. No, we're not spies. You know, we're just a bunch of brothers from the land of Canaan. We're hungry. We're here to buy food. And we have a dad. You know, there used to be 12 of us. Now there's only 11 because one of the brothers is no more. And we left our youngest brother back with our father. So they're divulging all of these details about their family, which is, of course, just what Joseph wanted them to do, because he doesn't know anything about what's happened with his family over the course of his time in Egypt. All he knows, the last thing that he knows about his brothers is that they stabbed him in the back. They sold him to these traitors. And for all he might know, they did the same to his full brother, Benjamin, just like they'd done to him. So Joseph's basically kind of feeling them out so he can get some details about what's happened over the course of the years. And finally, Joseph really doesn't drop the accusation that they're there as spies. But what he says is look, if you're really honest, if you are honest men, then here's what we're going to do. We're going to kind of do a trade here. So I'm going to hold one of your brothers hostage. And you go get your youngest brother that you claim that you have and bring him back. And if you bring back your youngest brother, then we'll be good. Your brother that I'm taking into custody, he'll be released. And everything will be, you will have proven to me that you are in fact honest men and you're not here as spies. So Joseph says all these things, and that's kind of where we left off. And then we were talking about verse 21, which is significant. And it's where the brothers say to each other, after all this happens, the brothers say to each other, truly, we are guilty concerning our brother. They mean Joseph, because we saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, yet we wouldn't listen. Therefore, so because of all that, this distress has come upon us. So we talked about how, old guilt never rusts, that phrase from Luther, that all these years they have been troubled by what they did to Joseph, and now they think that everything that's happening to them, especially this, is kind of karma, I guess you'd say. All of this is coming back to finally to bite them. I think it's what they did in the past. So that's kind of where we left off. Long recap, but that kind of sets the tone for what we're about to see. So what happens next? Well, Reuben, remember, he's the oldest. He's the firstborn. Reuben picks up the conversation there in verse 22. He kind of takes advantage of the situation to say, "I told you so." He says, "Did I not tell you, don't sin against the boy, and you wouldn't listen to me?" Now comes the reckoning for his blood. See, if you remember the story back in the day when they had Joseph down in the pit, Reuben was not party to the scheme to sell Joseph. He wanted actually to rescue his brother. And then when he comes back and he finds the pit empty, he assumes the worst. He thinks Joseph is gone. In fact, it's almost as if he thinks Joseph is dead. In fact, we don't know for sure if the brothers ever told Reuben the whole story of what they did. But Reuben is hearkening back to that, and he's saying to his brothers, "Look, you're right. All this is happening to us because of Joseph. And if you'd listened to me to begin with, none of this would have happened." So a family quarrel is going on, basically. Everybody's lamenting what's happened to them. They're beating themselves up. And then Reuben jumps into the fray and says, "I told you so." So all this is going on, this kind of back and forth and arguing and fighting. And what they don't realize, and this is where the story goes from here, what they don't realize is that Joseph understood every word. It says there was an interpreter between them. So here's Joseph. He's on one side, and here are the brothers. You can see them all, kind of standing around arguing with each other. And there's an interpreter that stands between Joseph and his brothers. But of course, Joseph doesn't need the interpreter. He knows Hebrew. His brothers don't realize who he is, and they don't realize he knows Hebrew. But he's listening in on every word they speak. Now, how does Joseph react to this?
Well, that whole thing is weird right there. First of all, like, it's a slick move to bring in an interpreter so that they'll feel like that you don't understand what they're saying. But yeah, if you do have an interpreter and you're the brothers, and if you don't want him to know this, which maybe you care, maybe you don't care, I don't know. But you have to assume that the interpreter is going to tell him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The brothers weren't thinking this through, were they?
I mean, maybe they don't care. Maybe they're like, "Well, this guy doesn't care for what we did to our brother." I don't know. Like,
yeah, maybe so.
But still, it's still a smooth move, because if the interpreter's ever, not in the room, they're going to assume, hey, this guy can't understand us. I mean, he had an interpreter in here after all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Little deception.
Little deception going on, which is of course what the brothers are skilled at. So you got this weird situation. And you got to wonder, okay, now how is Joseph going to react to all this? Is he going to almost kind of laugh under his breath, seeing the distress of his brothers? Is he going to be angry at them still? I mean, how's he going to react to this? Well, it's kind of a weird situation, because you have two things happening which seem diametrically opposed to each other in the exact same verse. Two things that Joseph does. So he hears his brothers, and in verse 24 now, it says he turned away from them and wept. And then he must have gone out, because it says later, then he returned to them. So he turns away from them and he weeps. And this is the first of many times that Joseph cries. There's a whole lot of weeping on Joseph's part going on in this narrative. And presumably he's weeping because he's upset as he listens to his brothers. And maybe he's thinking back to what happened to him. And so maybe they're more tears of kind of grief over what he's gone through, or maybe they're tears of grief over the fact that his brothers are still divided, or that they still feel guilty about what they did. I don't know. Of course, tears can be interpreted lots of different ways. He turns away and he weeps. So that happens. He must have gone out, like he does in other situations, to kind of clean himself up, wash his face. When he goes back to them, he speaks to them and he takes Simeon from them, who was the second in line, second born, and binds him before their eyes. See, he kind of got a he, almost a good cop, bad cop situation here, in which Joseph is both. He cries, he goes out of the room, but then when he comes back, he has the one brother, Simeon, bound before their eyes and put into custody. So I guess that's Joseph for you. He's a man of mystery in some ways throughout this part of the story in particular. I still am trying to wrap my mind exactly around why Joseph does everything that he does. And I mean, on the one hand, as the story goes on, it's almost as if this whole thing is nothing more than Joseph's way of testing his brothers. He's trying to find out, first of all, if they're still the same men as they were 20 years ago. Trying to find out if they are repentant over what they did. He's trying to find out just basic details about his family. I mean, did they do to his brother what they did to him? So it's as if this whole thing is kind of an investigation for him into who his brothers are now. And then at the same time, you have him doing things to his brothers, which seems rather heartless. For example, keeping one of them in jail for however long we have between these two visits to the brothers, and accusing them and speaking harshly to them. So he acts in a very harsh way toward his brothers. But then at the same time, he'll turn around, as we're going to see in just a minute, and for instance, give them all their money back that they used to buy the grain. He puts every bit of money they use to purchase grain, he gives it back to them. So it's an act of love and mercy toward them. So I don't know. Maybe by the time we finish this, we'll have this all figured out. But Joseph is right now anyway, he's kind of a mystery to me, is what his real motives are here.
Well, he's that revenge is real cold that he's serving up.
What in arresting his brother, you mean?
Yeah,
Yeah.
just messing with him, like, yeah, it seems like there's probably like a real struggle going on here. Joseph being Simmel and all, but like, there's probably this real desire to like watch you squirm, you know, pay you back to some degree anyway, a little bit, you know, evaluate your regret, all that kind of thing. But at the same time, like, he obviously still cares deeply for his brothers. That's why he's out weeping, and he didn't want their stuff. That's why he's giving it back. This is a guy that like ultimately just wants an apology. And not even that, well, and not even an apology. I don't think he needs him to say I'm sorry. He just needs to know that there is regret. That's enough.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately what he's shooting for. If you look at the end of the story, he's forgiven them, and yet I think he's still working through that forgiveness. And maybe that's the way it is in families. You know, we can, whether it's between a husband and wife, or between brothers, or between even parents and children, you know, there can be a speaking of forgiveness and an accepting of forgiveness, but that doesn't mean that everything is just fine, especially in human relationships, you know. So Joseph maybe has forgiven his brothers, but at the same time, he's still struggling with this very real fight over the desire to make sure his brothers understand just what they've done, and to make him squirm, as you say.
Yeah, well, I think that when you're in a relationship with somebody and something bad happens, you can forgive, but things aren't sort of restored unless, you know, like I can forgive you without you even and maybe even acknowledging that what you've done is wrong, or without you regretting any of it. I can still forgive you. That doesn't mean that like we're not restored. Just because I've forgiven you, we're not restored. Like that would require that would require that the other party wishing that hadn't happened, feeling regret over it. And so I think that you have some of that. I don't think that he's wanting to withhold forgiveness, but can these relationships be restored? I would say, well, the answer is no if they're just like, well, like we've freaking did this thing to our brother, and he was a real punk, so he deserved it, but I guess maybe this has happened to us because of that. Like, no sorrow over it, no, like, oh man, like, well, man, remember when we did that and how bad we feel? Like, that makes it all very different.
I think that's I think you're onto it. You're onto it there. This whole narrative is in sort of a roundabout way, Joseph, or God using Joseph, I guess I should say, to work about the restoration of the family. Because there's obviously there's still big problems in this family. I mean, Jacob is still playing favorites. That's why Benjamin isn't there to begin with on this trip. You've got Simeon now separated from the group. You've got Judah and Reuben kind of vying for leadership of the brothers, and Reuben is going to fall by the wayside pretty soon, and Judah's going to assume leadership of the group. And you got the dad still back, in the Holy Land. He's holding back on Benjamin, doesn't want to let him go, as we're going to see as the story progresses. So yeah, it's still a family that is torn apart by jealousy and spite and lies and deceit and all this kind of stuff. So this is Joseph in his way trying to finally bring about the true reconciliation that needs to happen, and that presumably does happen over time, although we're still a ways from that happening. So here's what happens as the story goes on. So he takes Simeon and he puts him in prison wherever he was held, and then Joseph gives orders that when his brothers aren't looking, that they're supposed to put back into these sacks of grain the money they used to purchase the grain to begin with. So of course they're unaware of this. So he gives them the food, he gives them the sacks of grain, and they load it on their donkeys and they take off. They're heading back home, and they get to they get to the Motel 6 that first night, and they're unpacking their stuff, and one of the guys happens to look in his bag of food, and lo and behold, there's the money. And so he calls his brothers together and he says, look, my money's been returned, it's in my sack. And this is very interesting. It says their hearts sank and they turned trembling to one another, and this is what they said. They said, what is this that God has done to us? Isn't that fascinating? That's in verse 28. What is this that God has done to us? What do you think's going on there? Why would they say that?
We came here to pay for this stuff, and now it looks like we're stealing our money back. This looks bad. This looks real
This looks
bad.
bad. Yeah, of course it makes them look like they're thieves. I mean, it kind of makes them look as if everything that Joseph accused them of being was true, that they were dishonest men. They were there not just to get food. They were there on a spy mission, espionage mission. And not only that, they're not only spies, but now they're thieves to boot. So, but what's fascinating to me is that they attribute this to God. What is this that God has done to us? So it's as if getting their money back was divine retribution for, presumably they meant for, what they'd done to their brother. They don't spell that out here, but what is this that God has done to us? And I was thinking about this, and this is sort of how guilt works. I don't think that Joseph gave them their money back to make them feel this way. He gave them the money back because like you said earlier, he didn't want their money. In fact, he wanted to be able to take care of his family. So he gave them the money back out of generosity, out of brotherly love and concern for their families. But they interpret that negatively. And not only did they interpret that action negatively, but they attribute it to God. So it's as if their guilt becomes the prism through which they interpret everything that happens to them, if you know what I mean. So even good things seem like they're nothing more than kind of Trojan horses, if you will, that are full of something bad that's going to happen. It's like, I guess you could say that the brothers are fully under the law here. And this law has worked on them to such an extent that everything that happens to them, whether it's a gift or whether it's a true curse, is interpreted as negative. Because that's the only way that they can understand themselves and their actions and what other people do to them. There's no understanding of grace here. There's no understanding of love. There's no understanding of generosity. It's all law. And since they're under this burden of law, that becomes the prism through which they interpret everything that happens to them.
Yeah, and it's weird though. We do have this idea of God, right? Like, well, God's gonna like pay me back for this. I mean, we would do the same. I mean, we might not do it in this way, but we very much are like, well, this is what I get. God is gonna like beat on my head for a while because of that thing I did.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. When we think of God as kind of a tit for tat deity, he's always, you do good, God does good to you. You do bad, God does bad to you. Well, that is a that that's interpreting God through a completely a law perspective. As if he's nothing more than, he's up in heaven and he's counting your good works. And if you have more good works than bad works, he's going to do good things for you. But if you have more sins than good works, then he's going to do bad things to you. That kind of deity is nothing more than a deity of the law, which that's what the law does, right? Do good, you'll be blessed. Do bad, you'll be cursed. And it completely divorces God from the cross. Which is where God discloses to us that he's a God of grace and mercy. And instead of giving us what we deserve, he gives us the exact opposite. There's an element of karma going on. It's nothing but grace. In fact, it's the exact opposite of karma. Karma says you get what you deserve. Grace says you get what you don't deserve. You get love, you get forgiveness, you get mercy. But the brothers and we very often are just like this. We think that God is going to reward us for our good and punish us for our evil, instead of understanding ourselves to be in grace in Christ, and because of that we are pleasing to God. And it's not based upon how good or how bad we are, it's based upon who we are in Christ Jesus. And if we are in him, there is no condemnation for us, because Christ has endured all condemnation in our stead. And so we're able to understand our life differently, and not always thinking, oh, this bad thing happened because I sinned, or oh, this good thing happened because I was good. No, it doesn't work that way. We are in grace, and because of that, we are in Christ. And yeah, there's bad things that are going to happen. There's good things that are going to happen, but it's not as if God is keeping track of how much good or bad we've done and acting toward us accordingly. He acts toward us according to Christ and to Christ alone.
That's right.
So that's where the brothers are. What is this that God has done to us? We've got this money back. That's what we don't need. So they make the rest of the trip. They get to their father back in the land of Canaan. They tell him the whole story. This is everything that happened to us. The Lord of the land, they call Joseph. He spoke harshly with us. He accused us of being spies. And here's what we told him. I mean, we told him, hey, we're honest guys. We're not spies. And then they tell their father everything they disclosed to the Lord of the land, about their family and how many brothers there are, and so on and so forth. And then they tell him that they can't go back unless they bring Benjamin with them. That's the only way they're going to be able to prove their honesty and be able to trade in Egypt. So they tell their father all of this. And then Verse 35 says, they emptied out all their sacks, and every man's sack of grain had his money in it. And they see it, and they're all dismayed. And Jacob says to, and this is Jacob's reaction. So we had the brother's reaction, right? What is this that God has done to us? This is the father's reaction. He says, you have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more, and you would take Benjamin. All these things are against me. So poor Jacob. Now he thinks he's lost. He hasn't lost any sons, but he thinks he's lost two and is on the verge of losing three. You know, as much as we might have said about Jacob earlier, how selfish and deceitful that he was, this is this time in his life has been the harshest. It's pretty hard not to feel some sympathy for him after all this. And then the chapter ends with Reuben, the firstborn, trying to in his own kind of twisted way, trying to smooth things over and take leadership, but it doesn't work. He says to his dad, he says, you may put my two sons to death if I do not bring him back to you. Put him, he's talking about Benjamin, put Benjamin in my care and I will return him to you. Let's go back to that in a second. But here's how Jacob responds, and this is how the chapter ends. Jacob says, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you're taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol in sorrow. Now, what I think is fascinating about Reuben's proposal, he's like, listen, Dad, I'm responsible. Let me take Benjamin with me. And if anything happens to him, you can put my two sons to death as punishment.
I'm sure that's something Jacob wants to do.
Yeah, like that's something that Jacob wants to hear and to do. Now, what's fascinating to me is that you've got Reuben saying this, but later on, when Judah comes up with his own plan, Judah puts himself responsible, and he says, "Look, if anything happens, then I will be the one who suffers as punishment."
Yeah, I don't think like being like, all right, listen, Dad, if I don't bring my brother back, you can kill your grandkids. It's like, what? That's what? Yeah. What? Like, why would I, like, okay, I don't like, who wants to do that? Like, that's not like some kind of guarantee.
Yeah, that's not what you want to hear. That's not going to be a motivation to actually follow this plan. Look, if it doesn't work, you can kill your two grandkids. I mean, I don't know. Reuben, after this, Reuben it fades from the scene. That's the last, it's his last contribution to the story. And it's a sad way to go out, but that's the way it ends.
Trying to put a dude's grandkids up for collateral is like not the way to get stuff done.
No, not the way to go. And, you know, it's interesting historically, too, just kind of to take a step back from this narrative to look at it in a broader biblical context, because what you see happening here is the emergence of Judah as the son who becomes the leader of all the other brothers. And not only that, but Judah as a tribe becomes the leader of the other tribes as well. You remember that, okay, Reuben is the firstborn, and then Simeon and Levi are the next two. Well, what's happened? Well, Reuben, as we heard several chapters ago, Reuben had slept with his father's co-wife, so kind of not really his stepmother, but kind of like that. And Jacob found out. So back then, Reuben basically discredited himself. So he's the firstborn, but he's lost really that leadership authority. I guess you could say the moral authority as firstborn, because Jacob is not pleased with him. The other brothers are obviously not listening to him. And then the second born is Simeon. Well, what happened to Simeon? Well, Simeon is now in jail back in Egypt in Joseph's personal dungeon. So he's gone. Levi and Simeon were the ringleaders of the massacre at Shechem, which we heard about a few chapters ago too, when they took vengeance on all the recently circumcised males of Shechem, went in and killed the whole male population with the edge of the sword. So the first three brothers in order of birth have now fallen out of the father's favor, are not going to receive any kind of blessing, and now have passed from any kind of leadership role among the brothers. And what happens now is that Judah, the fourth born, Judah is the one who comes more and more into prominence as the leader of the brothers. This is gonna continue in the next chapter, because it's Judah's plan that finally Jacob listens to as they go back down into Egypt. It will be Judah who steps before Joseph and pleads for the life of his brothers. He becomes really the mouthpiece of the rest of the brothers. And then as the biblical story goes on, it will be Judah who finally emerges as the tribe that will be the tribe from whence the kings of Israel come. So David is from the tribe of Judah, and all the kings who follow him will be from the tribe of Judah as well. And most significantly, in the blessing that Jacob pronounces upon Judah, there is the prophecy of the Messiah who will come from that tribe. And of course, the Messiah is the son of David. In fact, he is even called David in some of the messianic prophecies that we see in Jeremiah and Ezekiel. So already here in Genesis, we see the emergence of what will become the messianic importance of Judah, not just as a man, but as a tribe, as the regal tribe, as history goes on. It's like so many other things that we see in the scriptures. You see the beginnings already in the book of Genesis of what's going to come to be to full flower later in the books of Kings and Chronicles, and in the rest of the prophets. That takes us to the end of chapter 42. We don't know how long the time between the first journey to Egypt to buy food and the second journey to Egypt to buy food happened. All that we know is that it was at least a few months. So they bring back food enough to take care of them for a while. Simeon's absence is felt acutely, I'm sure. And every time they turn around, they realize Simeon is not there, and Simeon not being there, being in Egypt in a prison, is a constant reminder of the danger they faced when they were there. But the diminishing amount of food on their tables every day is a reminder of how much they have to go back to Egypt eventually. So that they're kind of caught between these two negative poles, because on the one hand, they're starving to death because the famine is severe. On the other hand, so that's one danger. But the other danger is that if they go back down into Egypt, then they're going to face this guy again, this lord of the land down there, who seems intent on doing them harm. So they wait a while. The famine is severe, and finally, when they're just about down to the last bit of grain that they have, finally Jacob speaks up and says, "Go back and buy us a little food." And it's at this point that Judah steps forward. Judah addresses his father and he says, "Look, Dad, the man," of course talking about Joseph, "the man solemnly warned us that we would not see his face unless our brother Benjamin is with us. So look, if you send our brother with us, we'll go down and we'll buy food. But if you don't send him, we are not going down to Egypt, because the guy said, unless your brother is with you, you won't see my face." So it's pretty cut and dried. Benjamin goes with us, or we don't go at all. And Israel, Jacob, he is wanting to hang. It's as if Benjamin has become his idol. I mean, this is the God he loves, and he cannot imagine what would happen to him if he loses Benjamin. He is so attached to him. It's amazing. He says, his response to Judah is, "Why did you treat me so badly by telling the man whether you still had another brother?" So he's shifting the blame onto his sons. Listen, why did you have to bring this up to begin with? Why did you tell him you had another brother? And Judah responds by telling him the truth. He says, "Look, the Lord of the land asked us about us and our relatives, and he asked about our father. He asked if we had another brother. So we answered his questions. You know, how are we supposed to know that he was going to say, 'Bring your youngest brother down here'? There's no way we could have anticipated that kind of response from him." And it's at this point that Judah says to his dad, he says, "Look, here's what we'll do. Send the boy," he's talking about Benjamin, "send the boy with me. We will arise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones." We got three generations about to starve to death. You, old man, and all of us parents and our kids. And then he says, "I myself will be surety for him." That Hebrew word is it's almost the idea of a kind of a co-signer on a debt, if you will. Like, you know, if he doesn't pay, then I'll pay. I'm going to be surety for him, for Benjamin. You may hold me responsible for him. If I don't bring him back to you and set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever. For if we hadn't delayed, by now we could have returned twice. So some time has gone by. So I mean, say what you will about Judah. In the earlier stories, Judah emerges as kind of a in a very negative light. I mean, you have the whole incident with him and Tamar. You have him basically saying, "Hey, we should sell our brother." But here he steps forward, and in almost a messianic kind of way, he puts his own life on the line. He says, "Look, if things don't go well, you hold me responsible, and I will put myself in a position where I will become the guilty one. I will become the sinful one if anything goes wrong." So, you know, for in this case of Judah, he's acting here out of not only need but self-sacrifice too. He's putting himself out there as the surety, the guarantee for Benjamin, because they have to go back down. Otherwise, it's gonna be the end of the family. So it's kind of a that's where we're at now in the story. We gotta find out what's gonna happen when they do go back, and we'll find out also kind of the plan of attack, if you will, that Jacob comes up with when they do go back down into Egypt. And
Yeah, it
it's
just
gonna get
makes
even
sense.
more hairier now as the story goes on.
Yeah, and at some point it just makes sense because you cannot have your son go down to Egypt so you don't lose him, or you can and then he can stay with you and starve to death. I mean, at some point you're up against it where you're like, okay, I can either like watch my son starve to death, or I can roll the dice on this,
Right.
send
Yeah,
him down to
it's got to
Egypt.
be one or the other. Either way, something has to happen. Yeah, they're at the crossroads right now.
Well, all right. That's gonna do it, man. That's gonna do this episode. So next week it's gonna get real interesting.
Well, we'll see what happens.
Well, hey guys, if you enjoy this podcast or any of the other stuff that we do at Christal Fest, the other podcasts or the articles or the city events, which you can come to the next city event in Dallas in October, and you should. That's October 29th. You can come hang out with me and Chad. We'll be there. It's gonna be awesome. You can find out more about all that stuff at ChristholdFast.org. And if you would like to support those things, these kind of things, you can go there and there's a support page where you can contribute, and that would really help us keep doing what we're doing. So we appreciate it. Thank you so much to those of you who have done that. And we will see you guys next week.